There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that brings together the best bits of today's show from Wednesday, October the 30th.
And we are looking at overtime. Huge focus on the gig economy in the US this morning. Also, here locally, we are looking at some interesting news that's come out this week from the Abu Dhabi Global Market. They have revised a lot of their employment regulations. And one of the things that has particularly caught our attention is a change to overtime provisions. It's got us all asking here in the Business Breakfast studio, does overtime still exist?
Yeah, this is Abu Dhabi Global Market's new overtime provisions for employees who work more than an average of 48 hours over a seven-day period. And they stipulate the following. Compensation can be either cash or time in lieu, or a combination of both, as decided by not the employee, but the employer. Now, if it's cash or monetary, it is in addition to the daily wage. So you get your daily wage plus 25% of the hourly rate. And if you're doing it overnight, so between 9 p.m. and 4 a.m., that rate goes up to time plus 50%. But, Mark, you've got a question about people working in financial centres and getting overtime.
I find it hard to believe. I can imagine, for instance, drivers, delivery motorcyclists getting paid overtime, you know, because you are very much on the clock doing those sort of jobs. In a factory, you might say you've got an eight-hour shift. That's hard enough. If you want to do another hour, if the company wants you to do another hour, you should get paid for it. Yes. Financial sector, what? I mean, I having worked in the financial services industry for a good portion of my life, I've never heard of it. I don't know how you'd apply it. People are expected to work until the job is done, effectively, or until you've achieved your target. It just doesn't work like it. You're not paid on the hour. You're paid what you bring to that hour.
You're paid for outcomes, aren't you?
Exactly.
Not inputs within that industry, typically. I'm like you. I don't get how it works. I mean, this is essentially Abu Dhabi Global Market is the Wall Street or the city of London, of Abu Dhabi. And the culture there is that you if you're a banker or a lawyer or a broker or a trader or whatever you are, you put in long, long hours.
You do the hard yards, don't you? I mean, if you went to an interview in any financial centre or other words, say, well, what's the overtime rate, please? They'd look at you sideways and you wouldn't get the job. So, it's an unusual one for me, this.
Look, to be honest, there's two things here for me that go beyond just the fact that this is a financial free zone of, like you say, banks and traders and people who are working on the clock, round the clock, different time zones, different jurisdictions. One is that I'm not sure that overtime is a very Gulf concept, full stop. I've been in this region for 20 years. I have certainly had bosses who have said, oh, okay, look, you did an extra day doing that. You went off and did this. You came to this event on a Saturday. You did this interview over the weekend and given me days in lieu for it as a discretion. But there has certainly never been anywhere I've worked here a case of, okay, that was three extra hours, four extra, do you know what I mean? A formalised overtime. And secondly, even bigger than us here in the UAE, I'm not sure that overtime exists in an always-on economy. I mean, if you think when you started your working lives, there was a very clear demarcation between work and not work. And now we're all on WhatsApp groups, we've all got email on our phones. It's not unusual at all for someone to get in touch with you, 5 o'clock, 7 o'clock, and say, can you just shoot off this email? Can you just do X? Can you just do Y? I mean, does that start counting as overtime? Do you sit there with a little ledger, maybe in notes on your phone, and write down that you've done an extra 20 minutes at 7 p.m. because you answered an email and you had a boss conversation with your boss, at a time that you weren't working? How on earth do you calculate overtime when you're always slightly connected into work?
Also, can you imagine injecting, for instance, overtime into our job? You'd constantly be clock watching to see how many hours you'd done, and you'd be saying, well, I'm going home now, or you have to pay me extra to stay and do the last hour of the business breakfast because I worked long yesterday. I'm over hours. I can understand in certain things, like, you know, pilots, you've got to, obviously, for safety reasons, you have to allow them to do only so much. But, you know, they've got a job to fulfil. And it doesn't float for me in this one.
I'm struggling to see it. The last time I got paid overtime as such was when I was paid an hourly wage working in the service sector in a bar or in a restaurant, which is probably 20-odd years ago now. And then it works. And if it is a public holiday, you get time and a half. So rather than £3 an hour, you get £4 an hour. And I get it works for those types of jobs. But
you were robbed, mate, because time and a half, if you're on £3 an hour, it's £4.50. So you should have done your sums.
That's Mancunian mathematics for you. But I get how it works, of course, in those jobs, and I've done them in the past. But for professional jobs, and in Abu Dhabi Global Market, that's essentially what we're talking about. I'm struggling to see how it works.
Yeah, to be fair, I mean, overtime here, and I'm having a look at Federal Law Number 8 of 1980 in the Regulation of Labour Relations, brackets, amended brackets, UA Labour Law, brackets.
Hashtag SWAT.
What AGGM is doing and what they've said they're doing is they are bringing it into line with UA federal law. And they are, because it does, and a lot of people won't realise this, it does actually say in UA Labour Law that you should work 8 hours. Employers can ask you to work another two. And then they have the 25% calculation, the 50% calculation. So what AGGM is bringing it into line, I guess our conversation is overtime still a thing that companies look at, calculate, and how do you even start to do it?
I was waiting for a delivery yesterday.
Good, that's going to be me this afternoon.
And they called in the afternoon to say, we tried to schedule your delivery this morning. Four till six is what I was told. What I didn't know is that their delivery was scheduled for 4 to 6 a.m.,
No way.
And I said, you can't be serious. You're not going to deliver to a residential area at 4 o'clock in the morning. And they said, yeah, we do. And I said, well, what are my options? Can I have it in the afternoon, tomorrow? And they said, no, because the tariff that the person who's sending it is on, you can only receive deliveries 4 till 6, 6 to 8, or 8 till 10 in the morning. That's it. Otherwise, I presume they just haven't paid enough. They're not paying premium prices to get whatever it is to come to you. And as I didn't know what I said, but please, very kindly, stick it in the bin. Thank you very much.
That is absolutely extraordinary.
Never, and I had this conversation with a guy who just was totally surprised by my line of questioning, who didn't have a clue what I was really trying to get at. But 6 hour delivery window, and that's it, on the tariff that the sender was on.
Bonkers.
Don't get me started on delivery companies here.
Well, I'll be overtime. Obviously, you expect delivery drivers to earn a bit of overtime if they go past hours, don't you? But working 4 o'clock in the morning, who would do that, eh?
Who would? They'd have to be crazy.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We are discussing overtime. New regulations coming out from the Abu Dhabi Global Market have got us all thinking about how overtime works here in the UAE. We're very pleased to be joined on the line by Ivor McGettigan, partner in the Employment and Incentives Practice in Abu Dhabi for the law firm Al Tamimi. Ivor, it's lovely to speak to you. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be on the line.
Do you want to tell us what the ADGM is actually doing here when it comes to overtime?
Sure. Just maybe take a step back and look at ADGM, because a lot of people compare ADGM with the DIFC. You know, both are financial free zones and both have the big international banks and a lot of similar characteristics. However, ADGM has one key difference from DIFC, and that is that on the island that hosts ADGM, we have Cleveland Clinic Hospital. So that's a 24/7, 365 day working operation where the staff are all rostered on 12 8-hour shifts. And then we have the Galleria Mall, which is now extended, and it's a huge mall that again has thousands of employees working shifts and roster systems. So what ADGM have done, and kudos to them for doing this, they have created a new employment regulation dealing with overtime, whereby they have adopted, you could say, the best international practice in relation to overtime. And what they've done is they've mirrored the European Working Time Directive regulations, whereby they say, let's not look at one day at a time in relation to overtime, which is what the onshore position is. They say, let's look at it in context of a working week, a month, or a reference period, as they call it, which is a four-month period. So what they say is, if you work 12 hours on Monday, no hours on Tuesday, 4 hours on Wednesday, 8 hours on Thursday, what does that average out at? And if that averages out at 8 hours a day, then there's no overtime payable. And that's common in, obviously, in the European Union, but also in other countries internationally in relation to particular sectors like oil and gas, healthcare, and certain 24/7 working environments. You can compare that to the onshore position, which is quite a blunt instrument. The labour law just simply says if you work more than 8 hours in one particular day, then you're entitled to overtime. Doesn't matter what you work the following day, or doesn't matter what the context is. So it's a much more blunt instrument. And from our point of view, a lot of our clients who are large employers running shifts really struggle with that, particularly international companies who are setting up lines that are working 24 hours. They can't really get their head around that. So, as I said, fair play to ADGM for taking this view, which is, I think, the first in the Middle East to bring this concept on board.
So revolutionary for people who, as you say, people working in a hospital who are working non-traditional shift work. There's a caveat in here, isn't there, if we look a little bit more at traditional white-collar positions for managerial and supervisory positions and those who internationally would be expected to work overtime without compensation.
Correct. And unfortunately for us lawyers and accountants and consultants working in ADGM, we can't take benefit of this. But nobody's feeling too sorry for us. But look, the onshore position is that there's already an exemption for people in quote-unquote managerial supervisory positions. But one of the issues onshore is no one's quite clear what that means. So, you know, one school of thought is, to be a manager doesn't mean a job title. It means you have to have the power of attorney from the company that you can actually bind the company into contracts. I mean, if that is the school of thought that would prevail, then you're talking about 6-7 employees that would be entitled to that exemption. But in practice, most companies don't provide overtime to people in supervisory positions. But what ADGM have done here, and I think it's really helpful, they've adopted that, but also said, let's look at international industry norms and who is or who is not paid overtime. Because one of the alternatives for them might have been to say, if you have a higher education diploma, professional qualification, you're not entitled to overtime. But that might have ruled out, say, for example, nurses who do have nursing degrees, but who are paid overtime internationally. So I think this is quite a good solution.
I presume that any overtime work that you're going to get paid for does not affect your end of service benefits.
That's correct, Malcolm.
So the you just paid purely on the basic salary. There's not plus.
No, so that's correct. And just to confirm in relation to the overtime payment itself, because, again, there's a lot of confusion, both onshore and in ADGM and DFC, that's calculated on total salary. So what they've created is if you have worked over that reference period of 4 months, if you have worked on average more than 40 hours per week, then you'll be entitled to that overtime calculation based on the total salary. And it's 1.25 times, and there's a particular formula for that. But you're right, Malcolm, it doesn't come into the end of service gratuity scenario in ADGM.
Either let's take this conversation out of ADGM and look at what's happening in the UAE as a whole. Are companies really paying, and again, I'm talking about sort of white-collar workers, the majority of people who'll be listening to us driving to work this morning to an office, are people really getting overtime payments?
White-collar, no, generally not. Blue-collar generally are. Unfortunately, the calculation isn't always done the right way. Sometimes it's on basic salary only rather than total salary. But for white collar, you know, for anybody with a professional qualification, they're not getting overtime. I mean, that's just the reality of it. And I think most of them wouldn't expect it if they come from if they worked in that environment in the US or UK. It's just not part and parcel of that ecosystem. I think the grey area is where you might be white collar, but maybe not in an industry like law or accountancy or consultancy, and you might feel you're entitled to overtime, but the reason it doesn't come up that often is generally employment disputes in the UAE only come to fruition at the termination of employment, so it's almost unheard of to have a dispute, an ongoing dispute between an employer and an employee who are in an ongoing employment relationship. So, you know, say for example, in the UK, they have a rights commission where you can go in and make a complaint against your employer during the currency of the employment relationship. That's almost unheard of here. Most people only bring a complaint to the Ministry of Labour where there is a termination, and then they will bring up other issues like overtime and whatever else, annual leave perhaps. So it's usually as a part of a broader challenge rather than just overtime in itself.
Ivor, very quickly before we let you go, in the office world with everyone, you know, always connected, emails on, WhatsApp groups, whatever it happens to be, is the concept of a 9-to-5, 8 hours, 48 hours, whatever it happens to be, largely redundant now that we're all always contacting each other and working bits and pieces anyway?
I totally agree. I think it is, particularly in the private sector, in the white-collar private sector, I think it is redundant in that sense.
Ivor, thank you very much for speaking to us. Ivor McGettigan, partner in the Employment and Incentives Practice in Abu Dhabi for Altamimi.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. The Business Breakfast's Pick of the Papers.
Sanooj Sharif is with us in the studio. Morning, Sanooj.
Good morning.
Stories out of Ajman, which makes a nice change. What's happening in the Northern Emirate?
Well, the police in Ajman have unveiled their all-new tourist police patrols. So these patrols will be serving visitors around major landmarks and attractions in the Emirate, and they'll be operating round the clock. The day shifts will be handled by female police officers and by male officers at night, and they will be deployed around the major hotspots. They'll be handling complaints, queries as well. And it's, you know, part of the strategy of the Emirate to boost their tourism-related initiatives. And, you know, we already have seen these tourism police patrol fleets in Abu Dhabi and Dubai. So Ajman is the latest Emirate.
I would have thought a nice, peaceful, sleepy Ajman probably didn't have too many problems with its tourists.
So I think, you know, it's ensuring that things are tackled before it gets out of hand. And this is a major boost for the Emirates tourism sector, because over the last 2 years, they've been doing a lot of initiatives have been launched in Ajman, and this being the latest in that direction.
Okay, quick quiz on Ajman. What do we think the population of Ajman is? Nearest the pin gets a breakfast in Ajman, courtesy of Brandy.
Then I've got an incentive to win it, haven't I?
400,000.
Oh, that was going to be my guess. Okay, I'm going to up that a little bit. I'm going to go for 475,000.
I would say 550.
You're all way too high. I'm on government.ae. The population is 262,000. 16% are Emiratis.
That's me buying Malcolm a croissant in Ajman then.
Brilliant. Looking forward to it with the police in attendance.
What else have you got for us, Sanooj?
Well, India is scheduled to host its first ever day-night cricket test match next month, and this will be against Bangladesh. It will be played at Kolkata's Eden Gardens, and this will be the first ever test match that both these teams will be playing. And it's one of those first big decisions that Indian Cricket Board's new president, Sourav Ganguly, has taken within just a week of his 9-month tenure. And initially, you know, there was resistance from Bangladeshi players, so he had to convince the Bangladesh Cricket Board to go ahead with these plans. And for a long time, even Indian cricketers have been objecting to playing with the pink ball, saying that, watching the ball, sighting the ball becomes difficult once the ball gets old. So those issues seem to have been settled now, and these teams are gearing up for their first ever day-night match.
One person who's not going to be playing is Shakib Al-Hassan, who's the star batsman of the Bangladesh side, but he's been banned
banned from cricket for 2 years with 1 year suspended after breaching the sport's anti-corruption code. What do you know about this, Snooj? I know you follow cricket closely.
Well, this news came out yesterday evening, and the charges against Shakib is that he did not report those approaches made by some of the bookies. Those approaches were not reported to the ICC or the authorities concerned, and that he wasn't directly involved in any of those, you know, match fixing or any of those issues. But the main charge against him is that he did not report those approaches.
So it's a lesser charge than match fixing, isn't it? Then it would be far more than a 1 year ban.
Yeah, but you know, it's a big blow for the team because he has been one of their most consistent players. And even at the recent World Cup, he was a major performer as well, both with the bat and ball, and in all formats of the game. And he was their captain as well, so it's a big blow for the team.
Big investigation, of course, here in the UAE, isn't there, into cricket match fixing going on at the moment. Maybe talk about that in a bit more depth at a later date, Snooj. Thanks very much indeed for that. Other stories that we're covering today. Can I go next?
You may.
Go.
Because it's a really nice headline by my former colleagues at Reuters. Beyond Meat butchered as stock sale ban lifted.
Yes.
This is Beyond Meat, which is the vegetarian...
Two puns in that one.
Meats.
The stock sale as well as the butchered.
Well, I'll give you a third one because Forbes says Beyond Meat has delivered its third quarterly earnings report as a public company, posting beefy earnings. Here's the deal. Beyond Meat is they make veggie burgers, don't they? But the meat-like veggie burgers.
They bleed.
And they bleed beetroot juice or something. And it was a bittersweet day for them yesterday. The good news was, as Forbes mentioned, they posted their first ever quarterly profit. Revenue was up to $92 million, and that was better than expectations. Happy days. So why did the stock fall by more than 20% yesterday?
Because the founders are now, and the investors and people are now allowed to sell their stakes.
Exactly. Ha! Oh, shit. Can we go for double figures here? The lock-in period. They had the IPO earlier this year. And when you do that, if you're one of the founders, yes, you get share sales, but you can't cash in on the first day. There's a lock-in period of a few months typically. That ended yesterday. So a lot of people sold out their shares. But the share price of this company has just been absolutely nuts. Have you been watching this one, Malcolm?
I've been reading about how successful it's been. I don't know how much it's up and how much it's down. What's the story?
It IPO'd back in, I think it was May. IPO'd at $25 a share.
Yeah.
By August, it was up at $240 per share.
10 times.
Just nonsense. And now it's back down to $80 a share. It's the grand old Duke of York. So these wild gyrations in the price are nothing new. It's now got a market value of about $5 billion, which is still quite hefty for a company that's doing maybe $500 million a year of profit. People clearly see the future. They know the trends. We're moving towards eating less meat. And I get that. But wow, you wouldn't want to touch that. A stock that's gone from 25 to 250 and back down to 80, all within the space of 6 months. That's not one for the retirement fund, I don't think, is it, Mel?
No, absolutely not. I've been looking at Saudi Arabia and what is, in the equity world, considered the red meat. This is the Saudi Aramco IPO. And Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman Al Saud has decided on a date, November the 3rd. Trading starting about a month later. They're going to launch it initially on the Tadawul Exchange, the Saudi stock market. It's being presented as a two-stage process. The one thing that jumps out about me is how much they're paying for all of the advisors to advise on this deal. $450 million. How much the lawyers and the likes of the big investment companies are going to earn on this. And, small investors will earn as well if the stock goes up, as people expect. There are several things that are worrying about this in some ways, is that there's been a much more of a focus on other forms of energy since Extinction Rebellion came into play and started demonstrating around the world. We've had Greta Thunberg. The price of oil was $80 a barrel when they first started talking about this IPO. Now it's down at $60 or so. And there's plenty of geopolitical tension going on as well. So what happens after that bell rings on the Tadawul, the day of the launch, remains to be seen. But we're going to be watching it with interest, that's for sure. But November the 3rd, that's the start date for the big Saudi Aramco IPO.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
We are talking property. Having a look at a new property report, Q3 report, coming out from Allsop and Allsop. One of our top stories this morning. Paul Kelly, Operations Director at Allsop and Allsop, is on the line with us now. Paul, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
Let's have a look at this headline figure, an 18% increase in cash buyers here in Dubai for Q3 compared to same quarter the year before. What does that tell you?
What it says to us here at Allsop and Allsop is there's returning and increasing confidence in the market. Cash buyers predominantly tend to be investors, so a return of investors to the markets. We also did a survey of 100 buyers that purchased through us over the summer months, and we found that 43% of those buyers were purchasing for investment. So I think the overall like headline, so to speak, at the moment is not that the market's obviously running away or people are diving back in, but that I think there is a slow return of investor confidence to the market.
What about people making the move from tenant to home owner?
Yeah, for the last 3 or 4 years, this is a cycle that we've been talking about, that people come to Dubai, they rent for anywhere between 2 to 5 years, they decide that they want to stay here for a little while longer, and they want to, rather than pay rent, they want to get on the property ladder. So in terms of mortgage buyers, Q3 on Q3, which predominantly are people wanting to get on the property ladders or end users, people moving up the chain, we saw a 27% increase. So again, there's a healthy demand. That this is something we see year on year, is an increase of people converting from tenants to purchasing a property.
So the 27% increase in mortgage buyers, so an uptick in both cash and mortgage buyers. What are your reports telling you about the price, though, that they're actually paying for these properties?
So Q3 on Q3, and I'll talk Q3 on Q3 and then 2018 and 2019, the year so far. Q3 on Q3 is really interesting. There's only a 1% drop in the sales price Q3 this year compared to Q3 last year. And obviously there can be lots of factors involved in that. But what we take, and what I mean by that is it could be different properties selling. We could have sold more expensive properties this year. But for only a 1% drop, what we're reading into that is, again, there's green shoots there that the market is stabilizing a little bit. We're not seeing the headline of 10% quarter on quarter like maybe we have been over the last couple of years. In terms of for the whole of 2018 compared to 2019 so far, there's been an 8% drop in property prices. So as always with statistics and data, there's different ways of looking at things. I'm careful not to put a headline out there that in 12 months property prices have only dropped 1%. But what we're saying is Q3 compared to Q3, it's only dropped 1%. And we're seeing this as a form of, and we've talked about it for a while, that, you know, whether are we reaching the bottom of the curve? Is the property stabilizing, et cetera, et cetera? We're seeing this as an indication that maybe it is.
The bit that I would really like you to try and put some analysis on is what we're seeing in terms of secondary market sales, or what you're seeing, versus off plan. You saw a 36% rise in secondary market sales. Okay, we'd probably expect that if a lot more both investors and ex-renters, now homeowners, were getting into the market. But a decrease in off-plan sales of 67%.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things within that. One, Allsop and Allsop, we're heavily secondary market-based company. Our main skill set, our main market operations is in the secondary market. So to some extent, you'd expect us to see a drop in off-plan sales. But also, I think there has been a lot less launches this year compared to last year, and even last year compared to the year before. And I know there's been some comments in the media the last couple of days, but I think it is an example at the moment of the market is kind of policing itself a little bit. There has been a drop in demand in off-plan launches, so there have been less off-plan launches. The government have recently formed the Higher Committee for Real Estate, which again is going to look into new launches and new projects more carefully and with more detail in terms of what they will approve to be built and what they won't approve to be built. So I think with all this going on, there's just with most developers, they've just hit a bit of a pause button, understandably, at the moment. So I think that's one reason for the dropping off plan sales, as well as the fact, like I say, we're also a heavily end-user, secondary market-based company.
Paul, we've got a Federal Reserve meeting tonight in the United States. Tim Fox of Emirates NBD just told us he is expecting them to cut interest rates by a quarter of 1%. That will be the third one this year. And, of course, that directly filters through to the cost of borrowing here in the UAE. My question is this. Has, or are you seeing, the lower cost of borrowing have an impact in sales in the secondary market?
Yes. 100%. The main, there's lots of conjecture around about why people aren't purchasing property in Dubai, or why the market might seem slow, or one thing or another. But the biggest barrier to entry to purchase a property in Dubai is actually the cost of doing so. With the initial down payments, I know we've talked about it before, you need about 33% with all fees and mortgage deposit included to purchase the property. And then in the past, like if you go back 12 months, the cost of borrowing money was a lot higher, and the debt ratio compared to your salary and compared to your income was a lot higher. So with the interest rates coming down, it means that the cost of borrowing money is a little bit easier. More people can qualify for a mortgage. And there's so much sentiment in the market, again, like we've talked of before, to purchase a property. So as soon as it gets that bit more affordable, there's always an uptick in people who are taking the leap and say, right, now this is the right time for us to get on the property ladder in Dubai.
Just a couple more minutes with you, Paul, and let's focus on the renter. You've been looking at what's happening with rental prices and with checks.
Yes. So checks, this is a really good development as far as I'm concerned. The number of one check payments, just this going back to Q2 and Q3, for one check payments has been a 7% decrease, and for three checks or more for the rental payments has been a 24% increase Q3 this year compared to Q3 last year, which I think is brilliant for the market. It's brilliant for Dubai in terms of just sustainability as a city as a whole. And we've always said we think we're moving on the path to a 12 check or a monthly instalments for people's rent, and might be another 2, 3, 4, 5 years before we get there, but we're definitely on that path, which is good. It should makes life more affordable for people.
A lot of people, though, will be looking at your numbers and hearing us talk about them and say, hang on, an average rental price drop of 10%. My rent hasn't gone out by 10%.
No, and it really depends, because even 10%, people have then got to make the choice where, okay, so I could move and get a 10% better rent, but within that you've got agency fees when you move property, because you'll have to pay the agent a commission who finds you a new property. You've got moving fees, which can add up, and then you've got the pain and discomfort of moving house, which can be a stressful time. So there's always that balance of, yes, you can look around the market and the rental prices have dropped, but it's whether they've dropped significantly enough for someone to say, right, well, I've done with where I'm living at the moment, I'm going to jump onto the next place because the monetary saving makes it worthwhile for me. So in terms of if someone does make the jump, yes, you're probably going to save a lot of money, but is that the right decision? It's so subjective to people's circumstances.
Paul Kelly, Operations Director at Allsop and Allsop, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much indeed for listening. We're back tomorrow morning, live on air, 6 a.m. with The Business Breakfast.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.